This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator Podcast Review of the Year. I'm Lara Prendergast. So, after all the shocks of 2016, most pundits predicted that 2017 would be a year of consolidation which would stabilise the global ship. They will all have been deeply disappointed then by a year that has had all the twists and turns of its predecessor. For the final Spectator podcast of the year, we're here to look back on the past 12 months before casting a tentative look ahead to 2018. We'll be dividing the year up into three sections: the general election, Brexit, and the rest of the world. First up, it's June's election, and I'm joined now to reflect on it by our editor, Fraser Nelson, our political correspondent, Katie Balls, and Tim Shipman, the Sunday Times' political editor, whose latest book, Fallout, looks at Theresa May's electoral disaster. So Tim, when you initially conceived of this year's book, you must have perhaps initially thought it was going to be a story of Theresa May's success. At what point did you realise it was going to actually be a story of Tory tragedy?
Well, I think there were several key moments. I mean, everyone obviously looks at the exit poll, but the moment for me when the wheels properly fell off was when Theresa May said nothing had changed, when she did a massive U-turn on her care policy. And she'd gone into an election essentially thinking that she couldn't possibly lose it and that in all likelihood she was going to increase her majority. And all the people around her felt the same way. And they behaved like a bunch of people trying to get a mandate to do lots of things in government and completely forgot that they had a general election to win.
The funny thing is that we're always told that nothing really changes in election campaigns. That's the received wisdom, that everybody's going through a little drama. But you take the opinion poll at the beginning of a campaign, that's pretty much your election result. And this year completely destroyed that consensus. It was a campaign where so much changed. In Tim's book, actually, and I do correct me, Tim, if I've got this wrong, but you actually credit the dementia tax phrase to our colleague Will Heaven, who wrote a Spectator blog about it.
He was the first one to sort of widely popularise it in Westminster. There was a chap none of us have ever heard of who put it on Twitter first, and it was picked up by various spinners, but Will was the first one to sort of write something substantial, and that was certainly the first time I'd seen the phrase. And as a result of that, you know, it was very obviously a phrase that was going to stick. It was a brilliant piece of journalism on Will's part.
Fraser, Tim mentions dementia tax, but I think it's fair to say that the Spectator were never fully behind Theresa May. Do you actually think we didn't really want her to win?
Well, it's certainly true that a lot of the sort of conservative-leaning press were very supportive of Theresa May throughout the campaign. Lots of favourable headlines, whereas we were rather rude pretty much all the way through. Morton Moreland, our illustrator, conceived of this her as a robot quite early on, and he had so much fun with that theme. So week after week we'd have the robot falling apart or looking a bit wobbly or just... And I also wasn't particularly enthusiastic about the manifesto. I thought the manifesto contained so much of bad Labour ideas, which we in The Spectator were opposing because we thought they were bad ideas. I'm not quite sure why you're supposed to cheer for them just because a Conservative is coming up with it. So we did a cover with the Theresa May's manifesto with a massive big headstone with her signing her name on the bottom of it as if she was republishing the Labour manifesto. So we weren't enthusiastic. And I was actually quite worried that she might come back with this massive majority and then impose not only an agenda, which I thought was a pretty bad agenda, but also a style of government that I was really worried about. A style where she would govern effectively through her two advisors, Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, with the cabinet not really being asked its opinion. Now, it was my impression during the campaign that because the word Conservative was hardly ever used, it was all Theresa May this, Theresa May that, my party will do this, that she was almost seeking a personal mandate in a kind of very un-British way. Now, subsequently, you know, this has been blamed on Lynton Crosby. Lynton Crosby will tell you, yes, her approval rating was through the roof, so of course you're going to campaign on her personally. This wasn't about her trying to take single person charge of her party or her government. I don't know what Tim thinks, but the number of cabinet members who, after the election, would tell me that she was running a rule of terror was quite striking. Before, they didn't say very much. They were like, okay, this might get us a majority if this is the price you pay for killing Labour in its heartlands, which a lot of them thought would happen, then they were willing to go along with it. So what I wanted her to do is to have a majority smaller than David Cameron's. It would still allow the Tories to govern, but it would be a reminder to her that she had not been given the mandate to govern in this rather imperious, personalised way Of course, she went on to lose her majority, which was, you know, as a Conservative supporter, I wasn't wild about, but I would have preferred that to Theresa May with a stonking big majority, because I think she was kind of turning in, she wasn't turning into a monster, but lots of the way she was running her government was turning pretty monstrous.
And I think that's right. And I think what became very clear during the election, because Theresa May was put at the heart of it, when things started to go wrong, the focus was much more on her than it might have been on another leader. And at the very moment when she needed to be really good, when the wheels were falling off, when the manifesto had been a disaster, when the polls were falling, there then came forward all these televised events at which Theresa May was put on the spot. And the public finally got to look at her properly. They hadn't seen her during the Conservative leadership election because it was handed to her on a plate. She'd never had to fight. She'd never had to explain herself to the public. And when the time came for her to do so, she simply wasn't up to it. And whatever she's got right since has almost been in defiance of her personal characteristics rather than as a result of them. The other point I'd make, the follow-up on what Fraser was saying, I think she was always, the May project was always this interesting amalgam of cheerleading from the Daily Mail and the policies of Ed Miliband. What happened during the general election campaign was that Jeremy Corbyn came along and did the policies of Ed Miliband, turned it up to number 11, as Spinal Tap would have it. He did that bit much better. And by doing the care policy, she started to lose the kind of voters who were reading the Daily Mail. So the general election campaign undermined both of the things that had put her in a strong position to start with.
Katie, how much of this do you think was actually all about Brexit?
I think at the time, lots of Conservatives thought they wished that Brexit had a bigger role in that campaign. They thought because Labour are in such a sore point on Brexit, perhaps they still are, because no one really knew what Labour's Brexit position is, because Labour are trying to keep working class voters on side, many of whom are pro-Brexit, but also trying to keep more metropolitan Liberal voters on side, that actually it would work really well if it was all about Brexit. But instead, they kept having to talk about domestic policies. And I think that started to unravel for the Conservatives, because all of a sudden the Tories had to come up with this manifesto. Because unlike with the 2015 manifesto, they were pretty sure they were going to win with a majority. They couldn't come up with a manifesto which sounded really nice, had these good news things. Like with Cameron, when that manifesto was kind of written on the proviso that they would go into another coalition and they could get rid of a lot of it, which meant it was much harder.
But there are a few mysteries of his campaign, and one I suspect Tim will be able to help us with. You should think that the basic thing of campaigning is that you don't spring a major policy surprise during the course of a campaign. And yet, here you've got the dementia tax, care policy, call it what you will, one of the most divisive issues in political debate in Europe right now, care for the elderly, changed at the very last minute. So how could this be allowed to happen? Did Lynton Crosby know about it? Did any cabinet member try to warn against it? Did Theresa May argue for this? I mean, it's a fairly major mistake. So how could it have been allowed to take place in the first place?
Well, I think there were bitter divisions over it. If you take the big picture, one of the interesting things I found writing this book was that when I came to the section on the manifesto and I was interviewing the people who wrote it, they kept saying, well, of course, it came out of all the stuff we'd done at the party conference. And then in the plan for Britain, which was supposed to be this blueprint for the future of the Parliament and for the 2020 manifesto. And I'd look blankly at people and say, what on earth is the plan for Britain? And in their heads, Team May had set up these five great challenges that the country was going to face. And in their plan for Britain, they'd begun to answer some of the questions about how they may tackle them. Now, the plan for Britain disappeared into obscurity in part because George Osborne became editor of the Evening Standard the day that it came out. But it's a measure of Team May's poor communication strategy that most journalists had no idea what the plan for Britain was, let alone members of the public. So they thought that there was a sort of consistent base to bring forward these big challenging subjects. Then in terms of the campaign, there were bitter divisions about whether to go ahead with this or not. Nick Timothy and Ben Gummer, who wrote the manifesto, felt that it was important to be honest with the public that some difficult decisions were necessary. Fiona Hill, who had probably the best political judgment in the campaign, though her performance in Downing Street is heavily criticised in my book, in the campaign, she was right to say we shouldn't be dropping this unannounced on the electorate. Lynton Crosby, I think he was aware of the broad outlines of of what was being proposed, but the specific proposals were never properly tested with the public in advance. And the manifesto was a very secretive process. It was not something that the whole cabinet got to see until the morning that they were publishing the thing. So you've got a sort of background communications and strategic disaster overlaid with a bunch of infighting and sort of tactical ineptitude when it comes to the announcement.
Katie, do you think actually in a way the result of the election was a good one because it's created a slightly more balanced debate about Brexit in the Commons?
Well, I think as Fraser said, a lot of Conservatives didn't really want Theresa May to get this massive majority. I spoke to another person who was Conservative-leaning and they think that the British public often gets it just about right, which is a situation where you didn't put Jeremy Corbyn in number 10, but you gave the Conservatives a real shock and now there is kind of more debate and every vote counts because it's a hung parliament. It might be exactly what they deserved. I think it makes Brexit a lot harder and you've got to bear in mind that the whole reason the Prime Minister apparently called this election, other than to crush the saboteurs, was to make Brexit an easier thing than it is for a very small majority. And now they have to somehow work out how they're going to get through that. And we've already seen how difficult that has been in the past few weeks when they lost their first meaningful vote.
The other wonderful thing is it stopped the Tories thinking that Brexit was their political weapon, that they would be the party of this. And some of the tone of the debate around Brexit, I was feeling really uncomfortable with. I mean, her idea that she portrayed herself as this great big, I want to hold an election so I can go over to Europe and biff the foreigners a bit better, please give me the ammunition to do that. And the country thought, actually, no, we're going to make you a laughingstock. And so I think that was a much needed corrective. Brexit was beginning to mutate into something rather ugly, something that nobody who campaigned for it, I exclude Theresa May, really intended it to become. And it was, so she was seeing, can I weaponise this into being my personal manifesto? And the answer, deliciously, was no.
And I think you also saw that with the fact that they lost so many younger voters in this election, and also young voters who perhaps hadn't voted for flocked to Corbyn. And part of that was perhaps tuition fees, part of it was Theresa May's careless comments on fox hunting, how great it is. But the other thing was, you had this very hard, inward-looking image of Brexit. I think it was a real turn-off for younger voters who aren't necessarily opposed to Brexit, but they need to be an outward-looking thing. And I think the Conservatives have hopefully learned their lesson from that.
And now everybody's wondering what young people are thinking and how to win them back, which is a brilliant change from up until that election, where nobody cared, thinking these young guys didn't vote, so let's just basically, you know, screw them over the benefit system and give all the money to the oldies.
Let's move on to Corbyn. Obviously, that took everyone by surprise. No one predicted what was going to happen. Do you think it shows...
With one exception, Carrie Murphy, who is Jeremy Corbyn's gatekeeper, bought herself a dress with 10 days to go, which she intended to wear to Buckingham Palace when he became Prime Minister. Oh. But I can find nobody else in Labour ranks who truly believed that he was going to triumph.
Does it not slightly show that none of us have a clue what we're talking about?
Well, I wouldn't quite go that far, but it is certainly true that, you know, we sit here with these podcasts with the magazines analysing whatever movements we think we discern in the political scene. And sometimes when things happen, people say, you political journalist, you don't know anything, you talk to your mates. But what made this election different was that even like MPs who spent every single day of the campaigning in their constituency, a lot of Labour MPs thought, I'm really going to lose by a very big margin. Every door I knock, they absolutely don't like Corbyn. It's just a disaster. And look at what happened in my locality in the May local elections, which, let's not forget, were almost the entire opposite of it. It's a complete Tory triumph in parts of the country where the Tory vote had been thought dead. So even to MPs who've been pounding the streets of their own constituency where they'd lived and worked for a great many years, were completely blindsided by the scale of the Corbyn vote. Now, to me, of course, partly this makes me think, okay, let's just, you know, give up as a commentator because the politics is too complicated. It moves in two different other ways. But then again, it shows how wonderfully, thrillingly unpredictable democracy can be. I mean, there are times in history where you do get new currents moving. And this does mean if you try to judge politics by the old templates, then it doesn't always work. And I think there are new currents moving now. We saw them take the SNP from nowhere to almost every seat in Scotland after the referendum. We saw them take Jeremy Corbyn from obscurity to party leader. And then to have him do better in this election than any other leader of any other party has done since the war in terms of increasing the share of the vote. And a lot of this happened in a way that's very difficult to discern, because you get a change in the electorate. People who didn't vote before, when they do decide to vote, that can change things. People can change their minds. And at a time where, you know, the Nate Silvers of this world were telling us that you can pretty much reduce the electorate to an algorithm and program things into a computer, you can tell the future. This year has yet again reminded us that human nature is too unpredictable for that, and that political journalists can do our best to describe what's happening. And if you read Tim Shipman's book, for example, you'll be as informed as the best informed person in London about what's going on inside the government. These things political journalists can do very well, but clairvoyance, that's something we can't do.
Just finally, is your book more a story of Tory incompetence or Labour success?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think if you look at the Corbyn campaign, what you can see is a group of people who had an analysis of the world that finally had its day. That didn't mean that it was an analysis that was correct 10 years earlier, and in 5 years' time it may not be correct again, but it certainly talked to the spirit of the times, and they had seen enough and done enough by that stage to be able to capitalise on things when they began to move in their direction. You know, the Tory government is not completely useless, but they have not had a good year. And a lot of good and clever people have made some poor decisions. And some of them have made those decisions for the reasons that Fraser was just outlining, that political operators, just the same as political journalists and pollsters, have all fallen victim to fighting the last battle and trying to correct the mistakes they made in 2015 and to analyse the situation in a way that they think they understand. But the key to all this is that new people have come into politics. One of the things I found doing this book was that after a lot of digging around and talking to people, I had far more idea about the Tories' internal polling than anybody else in the campaign did at the time around Theresa May. They didn't have the information that they needed to make good decisions. But actually, by the end of it, not everybody got it all wrong. YouGov and Jim Messina both had, the guy who was working for the Conservative Party, both had good polling, good modelling by the end of it that turned out not to be far away from the situation. But what they were victims of was this huge turbulence that we're seeing in politics at the moment. The Tories were fighting on a battlefield that they had drawn up at the start of the campaign, and after the manifesto and the plunge in the polls, the battlefield had completely changed, and it took them probably 2 weeks to work out that that was the case. And so they were firing their bullets in the wrong places.
Things are moving so fast. You think you're going to have enough material for a third book next year?
I hope it's not next year. Otherwise, my wife will probably have something to say about that. But I think it looks fairly inevitable that I'll have to complete the trilogy at some point once we're done with Brexit. We've had All Out War and Fallout. I'm thinking the third one's probably just going to be out. But whether it's out of breath or
out.
Down and out, passed out.
Out of power.
Out of power, we'll see.
That was Fraser Nelson, Katie Balls and Tim Shipman.
Discover perfect presents and hand-selected wines for the festive season at Berry Brothers and Rudd. Visit bbr.com to browse the range.
Next up, we turn our attention to the ongoing Brexit saga. I'm joined now to discuss by our political editor Jane Forsyth and the New Statesman special correspondent Stephen Bush. So Stephen, do you think it's fair to say that Brexit hasn't been quite the disaster this year that everyone predicted it would be?
No, actually, I don't. We've had a year in which the developed world has had its best pre-crisis growth. The United Kingdom is growing, but at a slower rate than everyone else. And more importantly, I think this has been a year in which the rhetoric of, oh, we'll get a fantastic arrangement, we will stand up on all sorts of things, has largely been revealed to be false. I'm going to caveat that with what I think is quite an important difference, which is that if you look at why people voted to leave in the country at large, not the things that people care about in terms of Brexit, in Westminster, which was effectively for us to have a greater control over immigration but without economic disruption, actually I think the Prime Minister is doing quite a good job as far as securing that. If you look at what the United Kingdom started out with its kind of negotiating asks, we've effectively conceded on everything other than what happens to EU citizens and their rights of family reunion. Now, if you are a pro-Brexit Conservative MP who cares about sovereignty, that's less good. However, if you are the average person who voted to leave, a non-disruptive exit where we ultimately have a greater level of control is quite a good deal. So I think the interesting kind of historical political question about how is Brexit going is, well, who is Brexit for? I think we're actually having a more successful Brexit for the needs of the 17 million people who voted to leave and the fears of the 16 million who voted to stay. I think in terms of the pet projects that drove the Brexit vote, I think it has been a less successful year.
James, I suppose often on this podcast we're fairly optimistic about Brexit. Do you think there's some reason for pessimism that we should be a bit more wary of?
I think the reason for pessimism is that the UK has wasted a lot of time, in that we're talking a couple of days before Christmas, and for the first time, the senior figures in the government sat down to actually talk about what kind of trade deal the UK actually wants. I think it was clearly a mistake for the government to trigger Article 50 without an idea, without a kind of even a secret plan for what it really wanted to achieve. And I think that has run the clock down, which does bend things in the EU's favour. But I've kind of two reflections. One is, if you look at the negotiations in phase one, that is where you would think the UK's position was at its weakest. Because by having accepted sequencing, that the EU can say, well, you can't move on to the bit you really want to and need to talk about, trade, until you agree with us on these things. Even there, the UK hasn't had to kind of give away wholesale. You know, the amount of money that the UK is offering is more than the UK wanted to offer, but less than the EU wanted. I mean, it's a classic negotiation. You've ended up about halfway there. I think, again, on EU citizens' rights, yes, you ended up with a role for the ECJ for 8 years, but it's not what the European Union wanted at the beginning, which was a kind of idea that the ECJ would rule over in perpetuity, in the same way that Russian Orthodox who lived in the Ottoman Empire were able to appeal to Moscow for protection, that Europeans, the EU citizens living in Britain in 40 years' time would be able to turn around and go to the ECJ asking them to protect them. That's not happened. I think the really interesting question is Ireland, because the paragraphs on Ireland in the Phase 1 report, which will turn into a legally binding document, are contradictory. A QC friend of mine said to me, if you put these into a kind of commercial law contract, people say, no, you can't do this because that bit contradicts that bit, which contradicts that bit. How that plays out, I think, could be hugely important, because I think if you ended up in a situation where it looked like Northern Ireland was either being ceded to the EU, then I think the Brexit deal could have a real problem getting through the House of Commons, because that would obviously alienate the DUP and quite a lot of Tory MPs. But if Britain ends up effectively staying fully harmonised with EU regulations after Brexit because of the needs of the Irish border, then I don't see how Brexit will deliver the economic benefits in the long term, but I think it could.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is, I would essentially agree with that. I think with the, I'd say, quite important caveat that the agreement, it feels to me, is open and shut in terms of what the EU, what EU member states, who ultimately have a veto too at the end of this, which is that there will be regulatory alignment between Northern Ireland and the Republic, as the internal politics, I think quite rightly, of both the DUP and the Conservatives are against having a border within the United Kingdom. That means, to use the phrase of Boris Johnson, becoming a regulatory vassal, right? That is the only way that you can keep the promises that Theresa May, when she stood up in the Commons 2 weeks ago, I think it was now, and went, you know, we'll all be out of the customs union in the United Kingdom, but there won't be a hard border on the Isle of Ireland, and there won't be one in the Irish Sea. Now, and this is where the difficulty of deciding this kind of thing by referendum becomes acute, because I think in terms of the reasons that people wanted to leave, you know, through every study, through every poll, I think that it's hard to claim that there is a large call in the country for the right to break away from regulations. However, James is absolutely right that if Brexit is going to not lead to decades of below-trend growth, then it's only through unlocking the potential of being more nimble in terms of trade and regulations, which mean you have a hard border. So it does kind of feel to me that the lack of preparation and thought about the Irish border means we will end up with some kind of, I can't believe it's not Brexit, because that's the only way to keep those promises.
I think on the regulation point, everyone thinks about regulation as, you know, how many people are allowed to climb up a ladder at the same time, how many hours people are allowed to work. I'm much less interested in that than I am about the industries of the future, where the UK is doing very well. For example, artificial intelligence, which at the end of the last European Council meeting, the EU were talking about how you would regulate artificial intelligence. I think the EU regulating artificial intelligence is a recipe for a complete disaster. And the UK needs to be outside of that. It needs to be able to have its own regulatory system for things like artificial intelligence, gene editing, autonomous vehicles. That's the kind of thing where the regulatory question is, to my mind, most pronounced. And I think it is quite interesting that one of the reasons why, you know, even Philip Hammond now doesn't want to simply kind of carry on accepting EU regulations in the future is he is a bit of a futurist, and he can see how, you know, EU regulations of fintech, for example, or EU regulations of artificial intelligence wouldn't actually suit the UK. And so I think this is one of the things coming down the line. And so I think the Irish border issue in some ways can be avoided, at least in the near term, because I suspect that the eventual fudge of a trade deal will be that if the UK will have a technical right to diverge, but the EU will have the right, if the UK chooses to diverge, to review the level of market access. I think at least initially you'd be able to find some way to get around the Irish border question. The thing is, in 10, 15, 20 years' time, can you still carry on getting around it?
Stephen, at this point, what do you think the chances are of Brexit not happening?
I think incredibly slim. I think that the Phase 1 agreement killed off two sort of preoccupations. One was the idea that Brexit wouldn't happen, and the second was exit without a deal. I think for various reasons, both of those things are more difficult / impossible. I just can't see what the path to Brexit not happening is. It feels to me that the average pro-Remain rebel doesn't quite seem to have understood the scale of the powers they passed when they voted to trigger Article 50. This meaningful vote noise just seems like nonsense. The point of Article 50, the beauty, if you like, the EU, and the horror if you are worried about it from a democratic perspective, is it effectively reduces the choices that the leaving nation makes, whether that's the Prime Minister, their Parliament, etc., etc. There is no meaningful vote once you've triggered Article 50.
James, how important has Corbyn been this year in terms of keeping the Tories together?
I think if the Labour Party was led by a fairly anodyne politician, say Yvette Cooper, I think there'd be far more Tory MPs prepared to say, look, if we can somehow find a way to either stay in the EU or stay in the EEA, but that involves the risk of a Labour government, that's a risk worth taking. I think people don't think like that because, as one of them admitted to me, what the ultimate nightmare scenario is, you end up with Brexit and Corbyn. And because I think it is fair to say that Jeremy Corbyn's heart isn't in the European project, it is entirely possible to see how that might happen. I think one of the intriguing questions for next year is how long Labour can keep up this incredibly clever dance of facing both ways at the same time on Brexit, where they haven't lost those northern and midland seats where you had skilled workers concerned about immigration undercutting wages in the future and so voted to leave because they were preoccupied with free movement, and then these kind of university town young graduates who have flocked to Labour in the election almost as a kind of symbol of kind of Remainer resistance, despite the fact that there was one political party that was standing on an explicitly pro-EU manifesto that didn't go anywhere in the Liberal Democrats.
Corbyn plus Brexit, is that a terrifying prospect, Stephen?
It's definitely a terrifying prospect for many Conservative MPs and quite a few Labour ones. I mean, I think where, and this is where my kind of Ramona colours start to show, I think the thing is, I think Brexit makes a Corbyn government significantly more likely. Labour only needs the smallest of historical swings to form a government next time. If there is, even under the most optimistic post-Brexit scenario, there is a period of adjustment as jobs which face the EU vanish and new ones are not then seamlessly created. Seeing as I think the one thing that June 2017 definitively proves is that Corbyn can at the least get votes by default, it feels to me that any Brexit that has any period of adjustment in it increases the chances of a Labour government rather than decreases it. The interesting question, as James says, is that because Jeremy Corbyn is relaxed about saying fairly Eurosceptic things, but he embodies a lot of the kind of cultural values that embattled Remainers feel are important to them, he is the perfect candidate for their kind of quantum Brexit. Now, the thing you would do if you wanted to force Labour out into open cover is the day after the election, Theresa May would have gone, the country has shown that Brexit wants to be done by some kind of grand committee, and then you invite Labour to work with you on that. Because Labour MPs know they have a problem with the free movement of people electorally, I don't think that actually would have harmed the type of Brexit Theresa May wants to pursue all that much. But it would have scuppered Labour's ability to be the protest vote for angry Remainers. She hasn't done that. And the thing is whatever happens with Brexit, right, there are 25% of the country think it's a disaster regardless of what the data says. Then you will have some people who will lose their jobs even if it's a success for everyone else, you know, like the Big Bang in the 1980s. And it feels to me at the moment that the Conservative Party is not really thinking at all about the fact that the only home for those voters is a Labour Party that terrifies them.
One of the best things that could happen for the Tories' political prospects would be for someone to set up, some big names, to set up a British version of Macron's En Marche. Because what they desperately need is some alternative receptacle for members of the upper middle class professions who are rampant Remainers who won't forgive the Tories for being what they are now, the party of Brexit.
Haven't people tried this? A few people have tried this.
No, yeah. But, well, that's why I said big names. With due respect to the people who tried this, I mean, you know, if there's one thing I could know that would help me predict the results of the next election, if you came and said to me, George Osborne, David Miliband and Nick Clegg held an event and they launched a new political party, I think that political party would get, say, 6% of the vote max. But 4%, that 4% of that, or 80% of that vote, would come out of people who voted, who would otherwise vote for Labour. And that would probably be enough to stop Labour from winning next time round. Because the Lib Dems, it just isn't working. Even with Vince Cable, who I think, other than Nigel Farage, is the most adept minor party politician in terms of getting media coverage and on telly. For some reason, the Lib Dem brand can't get going.
I think a lot of young people feel they were betrayed by them, so they're never going to...
I also think the thing is that, yeah, Remainers can count. They understand that the Lib Dems are an ineffective lever to pull if you want to punish the government. Yeah, one of the achievements Labour had is they have this coalition of people who like Corbyn but dislike Labour, people who like Labour but dislike Corbyn, and then crucially a chunk of people who are very, very angry about Brexit. And although the conduct of the snap election was not very good, I think the thing Theresa May got right is that some people who voted Conservative in 2015 are going to lose out because of the Brexit process. And you have to get some voters from somewhere else to make up for losing those voters. She failed to get as many votes as she needed to replace those people in the right places. She, you know, gained a bunch of actually useless votes, giving Gloria Di Piero a fright in Ashfield, but crucially lost votes in Kensington. But that central insight that you have got to, if you're the Conservative Party, find some way of rebalancing the electoral coalition around the winners from Brexit, just as Margaret Thatcher had a coalition around the winners of Thatcherism. The difficulty is, I agree again with James, that if you had a pro-European party that was viable, that changes the electoral maths. The difficulty is I don't know what a version of Brexit looks like that holds together the Conservatives' electoral coalition. And the missing debate is not just over what the end state of Brexit looks like, but what is the plan for not just a Conservative government to oversee Brexit, but to get to manage the Brexit process to its completion? Because actually, the moment when we're able to say Brexit success or failure is not 2022, it's 2030, 2040. And if midway through that they are knocked off and Corbyn becomes Prime Minister, it feels unlikely to me that the average Conservative Brexit will be happy with the flavour of Brexit which emerges from that.
James, how do you think the strength of the union is looking at this stage?
So, I was a slightly against the grain type, in that one of the reasons I voted for Brexit was to help preserve the union. I think if you look at what the European Union does, it offers small parts of larger nation states. It says to them, oh look, you can have all the benefits that you get from being part of a larger federation this way. There is a reason why the SNP had embraced independence in Europe as their kind of intellectual leitmotif. And one of the things I thought was very striking during the 2014 Scottish referendum campaign was that Alex Salmond's answer to nearly every question was, well, we'll both be in the EU, so that won't be a problem. You know, there won't be a border post at Berwick-upon-Tweed because there'll be free movement between England and Scotland. Oh, there won't be any problem with tariffs because there'll be, you know, free trade, you know, frictionless trade because of the EU single market. And so I think, in a way, by knocking Brexit, by taking away the SNP's entire intellectual argument for independence that they developed over the last 20 years, has strengthened the union. I also think that one of the other things that's happened in Scottish politics is, and I think if Scotland voted for independence, the other thing would have happened, is that the Brexit process is showing that if separating a 40-year-old, largely economic union is proving to be this complicated, how complicated would it be to break apart a 300-year union that covers politics, the military, economics, society? You know, I mean, it would make the Brexit process, it would be the PhD in comparison to the Brexit process kind of key stage 3 test. I mean, it really is, would be so much more complicated. And I think that is kind of pushing some Scottish voters away from independence. And also, the other thing is, yet another economic risk. I think that is the other thing, arguing against independence at the moment in Scotland.
Yeah, so I think that is true about the union with England, Scotland and Wales. It has made the economic case for independence a lot more difficult to prosecute. The risk is if Brexit goes badly, whether in the short or the long term, the emotional case for England, even though actually England and Wales and quite a large chunk of Scotland, but the argument for England has done this to you is in a quite an emotionally powerful one. And the sense of, oh, there's a lifeboat where you can have everything back to how it was on the 22nd of June 2016 has the potential to be powerful if Brexit's a disaster, but it's only the potential. I think you can tell that that Brexit strengthens the union in some ways, because two parties who, let's be honest, do not care all that much about the EU one way or the other. Sinn Féin, who campaigned against the Lisbon Treaty in both the Republic and in Northern Ireland, and the DUP, again, a party which is perfectly happy to diverge from the United Kingdom on a variety of issues. The reasons why they came down on the sides they did of that referendum is because they thought, for one reason or another, that EU membership made their cases weaker or harder. But in Ireland, at least, on the Isle of Ireland, Brexit will mean that the border will not be an ignorable factor of Irish political life. That may help the union between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. That may speed forward reunification of the North and the South. It's really too early to tell. However, I think it is true to say that the advantage of Brexit from a strictly unionist perspective in Northern Ireland is it does mean the border can't be ignored anymore. And the kind of quiet death of unionism has definitely been averted there. It may be averted by a very loud and messy death of unionism, but I can completely see the unionist case for Brexit in an Irish context.
Just finally, if you had to predict next year where the kind of moments of big political upheaval might be, where would you think they would be?
I think there's going to be a massive Tory row when the end state is announced, when Theresa May gives whatever it's going to be, Florence 2, you know, some other, probably Amsterdam or Rotterdam, some great trading centre of Europe. She stands up and says that this is what Britain wants out of a trading relationship. If that speech is meaningful rather than a series of fudges, that I think will precipitate a Tory argument about what the point of Brexit is. I think there will be another row, which I think will come, is I think at the start of the trade talks in March, there will be some fireworks because it's a negotiation. It will suit the Europeans to come out and say initially what Theresa May is asking for is impossible, we can't do that, and then you'll see the great dance will start. Those are what I think the flashpoints are. And I think the other interesting question is the House of Commons has now inflicted its first defeat on the government on Brexit. Those kind of rebellions, they either create more of them, they show that it can be done, or they concentrate minds and people begin to think, do we really want to do this? And I mean, that is very important, because when this bill goes to the House of Lords, there are lots of people in the House of Lords who would actually be prepared to almost pull down the entirety of the House of Lords if that could soften or stop Brexit. And they will take, where kind of more moderate peers act will depend on how much the House of Commons has changed the bill. At the moment, it's only one amendment. If it turns out to be quite a few, then I think you'll see the Lords taking a wrecking ball to the EU withdrawal bill, which could have huge constitutional consequences.
Yes, I think that is exactly right. A lot depends on how much freedom the Lords think they have. I actually think 2018 will be quite a quiet year in British politics in terms of Brexit. In a prediction, I'm worried is going to be hilariously stupid.
We'll play that back at the start of it.
So Tim Chipman's also said he doesn't think there's going to be enough material for another book.
Simply because at every stage, the moment, you know, when the government has been offered a choice between the cliff edge and, to be honest, capitulation, it's decided that actually a bad deal is quite a lot better than no deal. And every day you get closer to the end of the Article 50 process, the damage of saying we're going to go for no deal because you have less time to prepare while the clock is ticking down becomes higher and higher. I just feel that if people weren't going to kick off over regulatory alignment in phase one, they may find... So the interesting thing is I think Remainers in 2017, when it seemed they still don't seem to have realised what a significant transfer of power to the executive voting for Article 50 was, will be Brexiteers in 2018, when I think that some people who have looked at phase one and go, oh, it's fine, we can fix that later, will realise later was actually December 2017. So I think there may be a tantrum, but I don't think it will go anywhere. I think the interesting flashpoint actually is the next budget, right? Effectively, the way Philip Hammond got through this budget was to end austerity. We had £23 billion of additional spending with this idea that at some point the books will be balanced because the cuts will become serious again next year. I don't see how there is a parliamentary majority for more serious cuts next year. Now, does he do what he did this year and go, actually, uncosted spending commitments are great, let's have some more of them? Or does he try and have a more austere budget? And actually, since the Lib Dems left government, the government has not been able to successfully pull off a fiscal tightening budget. It has fallen apart every time they've tried. And I think that is probably the more interesting fight in 2018.
That was James Forsyth and Stephen Bush. And finally, it's been a busy year in Britain, but we must embrace our new global outlook and remember that it's also been a year of turmoil across the world. To discuss the situations in Asia and France, I'm joined now by Jonathan Femby, author of Will China Dominate the 21st Century and chairman of the China team at T.S. Lombard. And then I'm also joined by Douglas Murray, associate editor of The Spectator and author of The Strange Death of Europe, to talk about populism, Islamism and the man in the White House. Through all that, I'll be joined by our deputy editor, Freddie Gray, who hosts our wonderful Americano podcast. So Jonathan, let's talk about China first. What do you think has been the most important story, really, to come out of China this year?
Well, there have been two stories of China. One was, one could say, logical and expected, which is the consolidation of Xi Jinping's power as probably the most powerful domestic leader in the world and spreading that influence abroad. That was a logical continuation of what he's been doing over his first 4 years in power. The thing which a lot of people hadn't expected at such an extent is that at least on the official figures, and we have to go on the official figures, the economy is holding up rather better than people thought it would in China, which of course adds to Xi's power in a sense. The two refract off one another. So that's been that. You could say also that the spread of China's influence, particularly not just in the region, but also the way that Xi Jinping has been able to walk through doors that have largely been opened for him by Donald Trump and become the great champion of globalization, of fighting climate change, of openness and everything else, while the actual record at home contradicts a great deal of that. But everybody around the world seems so anxious to find an anti-Trump that they're willing to embrace Big Daddy Xi.
But over the last year, how do you think Trump and Xi Jinping's relationship has changed?
Well, his trip to China was relatively successful by, you know, what the standards that everyone set.
Both sides, yeah.
But I think Jonathan's absolutely right that the fascinating thing is Trump seems quite willing to let China play the global leader card, you know, and the extraordinary thing is how people like President Macron in France are very willing to also embrace China as the real, you know, the sort of global leader, the global cop, good cop. And Trump, you know, will focus on America first and the two powers will separate. And so we're now seeing the end of a unilateral American era. I think that's inevitable. Mm. But it's interesting also that everybody's accepting China so gladly because they're also revolted by Trump, that they're not asking the questions they used to ask about China quite so much.
Well, absolutely, because, I mean, you know, who hears of human rights these days? That's a complete, you know, it's a non-word in the international lexicon. And the irony is that this embrace of China, as we put it, has taken place at just the time when internally Xi Jinping has really been tightening the screws hugely. Human rights lawyers, we know what's been happening to them, but also the crackdown in the West on Xinjiang, which has reached pretty extreme proportions with people having to give their DNA and so on so you can take them. And this plan for what's called a social credit. It sounds very, very nice, social credit somehow. What it actually means is using big data, mining big data, to have a file on everybody which logs everything they do, basically, including possibly their behavior online. And this will then determine whether you can get a job, where you can live, etc., etc. This is a real kind of control freakery, which we're getting.
But is this just something that happens when a country reaches global superpower status. They can control the narrative about themselves, they can control what people say about themselves.
Yes, and it's interesting, except, I mean, you know, if you talk about the United States after 1945, when it was rising to, okay, there was the Soviet Union, but it was always really the global leader from that point, and then, of course, much more afterwards, you had a lot of criticism going on in the rest of the world at the same time about, say, you know, civil rights in America or about the behaviour and this, that and the other, and it seems China's got a pretty clear pass at the moment.
Well, they don't have this free speech problem.
That is a great advantage, it must be said.
Do you think you've got any sense yet of what Trump's China policy is, or is it just he hasn't really thought of one?
I mean, I think the North Korea aggro is obviously aimed at China, and I think my pet theory on this is it's much more H.R. McMaster and the generals than people recognise. I think everybody looks at Trump's Twitter feed and thinks, oh, he's gone crazy again, but I think there's very much a sort of push within the generals, within the administration, the so-called grown-ups, to really sort of force China to step up in the region and, again, accept that they are a regional superpower and they're going to have to control this errant neighbour, which is North Korea.
But the problem there, I agree, that's what they'd like, and that's where US policy seems to go. But the China policy, I think, long-term, is to make the People's Republic the dominant power in East Asia and so on. And the problem for the Americans is that if the Chinese are going to be very unwilling to do anything that actually seems to back up the US presence and US power. So, in a sense, you've almost got to, I would say, I mean, this is exaggerating to some extent, if you're leading the kind of American policy you're talking about, you've almost got to say, get together with us, let's deal with the young rocket man and so on, and then we, the Americans, will pull back, which, of course, they're not going to do, partly because there's Japan there. And then you get the whole Japanese nuclear question coming out of the woodwork.
Yes. Is China comfortable with being with having no buffer with South Korea?
No. I think the Chinese basically would like the Korean situation to remain as it is without feeling, and this is what's been interesting in the last few months, a definite feeling, I think, more on a popular basis in China than necessarily from the leadership. Hey, if there's a nuclear conflagration over North Korea, there'll be mushroom clouds over Manchuria soon. And we saw that with, you know, in Jilin province, local newspapers telling people how to wash their clothes if there was a nuclear cloud over them. Talk of refugee camps being set up along the border and so on and so on. You know, this is quite a threat to China itself. And Chinese friends were talking about this back in the summer, you know, that it was one of the, hey, what happens to us and to our northeast if there is a war in Korea?
That's just about the relationship between Japan and China, because the impression we have is that it's pretty bad. Is that a fair...?
It has been bad, and it's been used, I would say, on both sides for a nationalist purpose, apart from, of course, the old history going back to 1894 and the Japanese invasion of Imperial China at that point. But interestingly, there have been some signs recently of a slight thawing there, and it's possible that Xi Jinping will make a visit to Tokyo in the course of 2018. That's being talked about. There have been some quite high-level discussions, and this, you know, in a sense, without being too Machiavellian about it, may be a line of Chinese policy, which is let's appeal to the Japanese, who've got a lot of investments, of course, in China. Mm-hmm. Let's all stand together. You come into our One Belt, One Road thing. We'll give you a few infrastructure projects, etc., etc. And in the end, we're all Asians together, and the Americans aren't.
And again, this would be an example of China being stepping up and being the sort of benevolent superpower.
Yes, the benevolent superpower. Now, I doubt whether Abe would go for that, given his attitude and background. But you could see, you know, it might play quite well in Japan.
Yes.
In the, maybe not next year, but the year after, or the year after, or one of these years.
John, then just finally, looking ahead to next year, what do you think we can expect to see from China and Xi Jinping?
Well, I think Xi Jinping, I mean, he'll go on asserting his power, you know, I am the new emperor, and so on, as we've said in the past, and so on. But I think you're going to get, domestically, quite an interesting change. And this was signalled in some of the subtext to his 3.5-hour speech to the Party Congress, which, in a sense, mirrors some of the concerns in the West at the moment, that, hey, we need to make China more equal. We need to spread the benefits of growth more widely. We've got to start looking after the old people better. We've got to have a better health system. All this kind of quality of life stuff. We've got to deal with income and regional disparities in China, which to me is a logical other side to this power accumulation, which he's got. I am the despot, but I am the benevolent despot who's going to look after you and make you happy.
Jonathan, let's now talk about France, because it's obviously been the year of Macron.
Yeah.
How has he made his mark on the world stage?
I think he's done pretty well. I'm a well-known pseudo-Macronite, at any rate. So I think, I mean, his life has been made very easy within France itself by the weakness, fragmentation and sheer lack of opposition. Nobody's standing up to him. He's been able to occupy a centre ground, pull in some of the Republicans, pull in some of the socialists, and play this kind of Jupiter 39-year-old, harbinger of the future role quite successfully. And just on the international stage, in a sense, he's been very, very active, but he's also been helped in a sense within Europe by the relative weakness of Merkel recently, by the confusions over Brexit, and above all by Trump and so on. So as with Xi Jinping in China, he's been able to walk with the Paris climate meeting and so on straight through it. Although it's interesting, when he talks about that on television the other night, he kept saying, "Oui, la France prend le leadership de la lutte contre le global warming, etc., etc." There's a perfectly good French word, which is direction, but somehow you feel that's a bit too cutting for him and so on. You prefer the Anglicism there. So he's done, he started, in a sense, the easy part of the reforms, the Labour code, because that would have been much prepared. I think people were ready for it. He says it'll take 2 years for what he's done so far, and on the apprenticeships and other tax policy and so on, it'll take 2 years for that to have an effect. And as I'm sure somebody said, 2 years is an awfully long time in politics. So there's a danger that the kind of momentum, which he certainly had to begin with, will fade, I think. And it's a very, what if he's going to bring the budget deficit down, as he says, that must mean a lot of cuts in health, in education, in transport, and so on. And although there may not be an organised movement against this, he's going to have to be very careful, I think, to deal with the national sentiment in general. And we know, how these things can boil over very easily.
Freddie, what do you make of Macron's first year in the job?
Well, I'm sorry to always talk about Trump. I don't see him as an anti-Trump. I see Macron as sort of mirror Trump in a way. He adopts many of his sort of techniques, and certainly social media. He's very savvy, and he's good at the sort of the public stunt. I don't remember when the climate change withdrawal thing happened. He went on social media, looked into the camera, and said, "We're going to make the planet great."
Great,
again.
Yes.
And that's just really cheesy and awful. And I think, after a while, he, just like Trump, has sort of run out of momentum very quickly. I think Macron could run out of momentum. I'm not taking away from anything he's done. It's an amazing achievement to have sort of created a political party, to have taken over a country, to have won an election against extraordinary odds in many ways. But he's had an incredible confluence of great luck. And of course, great leaders do have great luck. But I wonder whether that momentum is already slowing down. And it will be interesting to see if Les Républicains can now form a more coherent opposition, or will that just help him further and the National Front will be split more and his only real opposition will be on the left with Mélenchon, who is also slightly too wild to be coherent at the moment. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely so. This is it. And, people are looking for kind of miracles from Macron and so on, and those are very difficult to deliver at the moment, even when you've got a parliamentary majority and so on. And then there's the whole Europe question beyond that, because he very much tacked his flag to European reform, development of Europe, etc., etc. But the Germans aren't too keen on what he's proposing at the moment, afraid of debt sharing and their savings going to pay for people in the south of Europe who they regard as indigent and lazy and not worthy of their money, etc. You've got uncertainty in Italy next year with the elections there, and you just feel you've got Brexit on the side at the same time, and pushing through some kind of big European project, which is what Macron would like to aim at in the end, with France in the driving seat, I think maybe an ask too far.
What about Le Pen? Is she a busted flush?
One of the most interesting things I thought in last year was how very bad she was in the last stages of the election. She was thought to be this incredibly accomplished performer, a great TV debater. Well, in the debates against Macron, she was terrible and almost seemed to be deliberately sabotaging her chances. So I think, yes, I think she's had a bad year, I'd say, bad year for Marine Le Pen. But what happens to the Front National now, I'd have no idea. So the theory has always been that Marion, the niece, would take over. But she's now, I think she's retired.
She retired. I mean, is she waiting her day to come back? It's been a bad year in France for all the politicians, except for Macron. Yeah. And his immediate court, his immediate surroundings and so on. And how you recompose out of that, because one of the other problems with France, Macron might not see it as a problem, is that the power of the presidency, which de Gaulle set up for himself and exercised for himself, is such that I think for a healthy system, you've got to have a decent opposition to questioning the president, who after all names the prime minister and the government and runs everything, basically. And if you don't have a coherent opposition with some sensible things to say, you risk the whole, as it were, unhappiness, which there will be, and discontent, undoubtedly, with Macron's changes and reforms, becoming a kind of confused in the streets. I'm not saying that necessarily 68 all over again, but perhaps I'm too much of an organisation man. But I think,
Do you think the opposition will remain fractured enough so that he could probably win re-election, but not sufficiently coherent that they can actually pass any significant legislation? Because you need an opposition in many ways to pass legislation.
Yes, you need an opposition and a serious debate about this.
Yes.
And I think the opposition will be divided. I mean, the National Front seems to be losing ground quite a lot. Internal divisions, as you say, Marine Le Pen, who presumably will hang on, but didn't perform when she needed to. You've got Mélenchon with the Trotskyite left, and I'm not sure, that he can push up much above the kind of 15% disgruntled following he has. You've got the socialists in meltdown completely. The Republicans, I'm quite doubtful about how they go. So,
And you've got that Debout la France, Nicolas Dupont-Aignan.
Yes.
And if he hadn't won 5%, then Fillon might well have got to the second
round.
Might
have got there.
Which is another example of how lucky Macron was.
Actually. Exactly. Yeah. So, you've got a period where all these politicians and parties need to recompose themselves, as one would say in France, but they haven't shown much sign of being able to do so to date.
And we're now also joined by Douglas Murray. Douglas, do you think that the rise of Macron shows a backlash against the rise of populism, which we were promised at the start of this year?
No, because I didn't believe in the rise of populism. I think the rise of populism was over-egged, over-argued. The alleged backlash against it is over-egged and over-argued. As a very slight correction that occurred in 2016. But only people who don't like what the public said in 2016 believe it's some wave of sort of almost criminal lunacy that needs correcting.
I would agree and disagree. I think there was an upsurge that we hadn't actually seen before of, if you like, rejection of the establishments, to put it into, whether those were governing establishments or opposition establishments, as we saw in France with the rejection of, the socialists and the Republicans by a lot of people. And I think there was this broad feeling, but I don't think it was ever going to get to the point of, seizing power. You see, I use the word seizing rather than winning power indicatively. It was always quite a limited phenomenon, I think, there. But, a number of, François Hollande was a great example of that, a number of elected leaders to very powerful posts are finding it very difficult to govern these days. And, whether that is populism or whether that is simply because they're not up to it, or whether it's because government has become too big or too complicated to do properly, I leave you to judge.
The other thing I'd add is that by a lot of definitions of populism that I might accept, Macron surely is a populist. I mean, he came from outside, broke apart the party structure, founded something totally different. If it wasn't for the fact that he happens to be a massive EU integrationist, among other things, everyone would describe him as populist. So it's not a technical definition. It's just a definition of things you don't like. Same with Angela Merkel, same with Germany, same with, it's the endless search for an arc of this narrative.
Freddie, you wrote a blog earlier this year and you said farewell Fillon, and then you asked, can establishment candidates ever win anywhere again? Do you think they can?
Well, Macron sort of proved they can, but they can by pretending not to be. I mean, that's the only way to do it. And I think the test which Jonathan and Douglas both suggested is that it's about sort of destroying established parties. And that's what's really happening, I think, in the thing that binds all these elections together. You see the established parties are really struggling, and it's not necessarily the politics that they represent, because Macron clearly does represent sort of established politics. But if you can at least pretend to be tearing things up, then you can probably win. But as we've said a number of times now, Macron's election was freakish.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, picking up from what both of you said, that because Macron was this individual who apparently came from nowhere, you know, kind of Superman flying in from wherever planet he flew in from, Jupiter, of course, that everybody thought, you know, he's upsetting things. He's the anti candidate, as it were. Whereas, in fact, if you go through his programme, much of it, particularly on the economic side, is what the Parisian elite have been asking for the last 20 years, you see. And their complaint has been, oh, we were promised this by Sarkozy, you know, and so on and so on. And people, and they never implemented it. And, of course, now it becomes, I think, more and more a question of when people are elected, perhaps outside the regular political parties, whether they can then actually implement what they said they were going to do. And, you know, if they don't, what do you do? How do you follow Trump? How do you follow Macron? Would be the question.
I just add one thing to that, which I think the most important election this year was in Austria, because it showed a correction that might be taking place in some European countries, which isn't in the favoured direction necessarily of me or indeed of the people who throw around the term populist, but it is something very striking. That is a European mainstream political class recognising that they have missed very significant issues, recognising that if they keep on abandoning them, only one type of politics does benefit, and it's the politics of the farthest out fringe, and doing the necessary correction, which is to take in that part which happens to be the general public, which wants to answer these things in a decent way.
But do you think that's what a lot of people thought Brexit was, perhaps? Or Brexit was the opportunity for the Conservative Party to do exactly
Yes, that was my thought about Brexit. It is my thought about Brexit. It's just that the
Theresa May made a
terrible manner of its, its carrying out suggests...
But the way it gets then subsumed in Britain into Conservative Party politics is the problem, in a sense, I think, with that whole process, both for and against Brexit.
Yes.
Douglas, the other big story has obviously been the rise of the AfD in Germany. Do you think they're going to prosper next year?
This all depends. I mean, it depends on, first of all, whether a Merkel coalition can hold together, and secondly, whether or not the facts on the ground speed up or remain the same. And when I say speed up, I don't just mean if numbers of people going into Germany continue, even the relatively lower rates they've been recently, but rather whether there are, for instance, any further mass casualty terror attacks, that sort of thing. At the moment, if they went straight back to election, it's not clear that the AfD would particularly benefit from that. So they may have hit their ceiling for now, but the facts on the ground, of course, can keep on allowing them to rise.
Freddie, Angela Merkel, how do you think she's fared this year?
Well, I think if you wanted to do the populism swing and then the anti-populism pendulum, the German election is a very good example of how bad that way of looking at things is, because you've got, what you've actually got is paralysis, and that's what you've got increasingly in all politics. You've got paralysis in Britain now since the general election. I think we're living in an age where there's a straining for a different type of politics, but everybody's a little bit too nervous to actually do it. And, you know, as Gramsci said, the old world is dying, but the new world is not ready to be born. I think we're in a stuck place.
Douglas, you obviously mentioned the attacks in Germany. Obviously, London's also had quite a few, and Manchester this year too. Do you think Islamist violence is now just a normal part of modern life?
Yes, it is, and it's subsumed into it in ways that we still don't understand. Let me give an example. We had three major terrorist attacks this year. We had two in London. We had the Manchester Arena bombing, and then a fourth attempted mass casualty terror attack in the Parsons Green bomb. The striking thing about it is that each time this happens, the politicians, and indeed every editorial writer pretty much, says it just goes to show the British won't be cowed, blitz spirit, etc., etc. There's no particular reason why Londoners today should have blitz spirit. Most are not descendants of Londoners. And there's no particular memory of it, and we haven't suffered night after night of mass death. What is striking is that as was shown in November in Oxford Circus, the public actually are thinking and absorbing about these things in a very different way.
in Oxford Circus tube station, two people seemed to have had some kind of minor altercation. It caused a stampede in which quite a lot of people were injured. It caused basically people shuttering themselves into massive department stores, people claiming there were shots fired, that a truck had mown down civilians, that there were bodies everywhere. So what you actually see is we talk a language of, we will never be cowed, we will not, they won't win, and all this sort of thing. But actually underneath it, the public have absorbed this, and we don't actually have Blitz spirit.
You think we're unconsciously much more nervous than we're
willing to
accept.
I mean, it's the same as in Paris, you know, since the November attacks in 2015. Quite a lot of things that don't get reported, they're sort of not big enough to report, but a short while after that, somebody throws some firecrackers in a street in the Marais, and quite a lot of diners are wounded because everyone starts to barricade themselves into the restaurant, thinking that it's a replay of the massacre. Mm. So I think that's actually... It's why there's a set of things now. You know, earlier this year, a minicab driver seems to have pressed the wrong thing with his foot, goes careering down a street near the Natural History Museum, and the whole area is shut down, people fleeing, it's another terrorist attack. No, it's actually just a sort of a minor road incident in which mercifully nobody was hurt. But that's how we see things now, and we pretend we don't, and so on. But of course, these things fundamentally change one's view of things. It doesn't mean you stop, it doesn't mean people stay at home, what other option have they got? But we have certainly absorbed this into our daily lives.
So it's a bit like living in a low-energy war zone, then?
No, I wouldn't say that. It's just we've accepted that it happens and that for the time being it's a price we're perfectly willing to pay.
I sometimes think SW1, you know, you look at things that are blocked now.
Oh, yeah.
That have just been blocked for about 6 months.
Well, you know...
That's just not normal. It shouldn't, we shouldn't treat it as normal, but we do. Yeah, heavily armed police.
And every Christmas market now has got armed police.
Every Christmas market. You say just down the road from us here, Westminster Bridge. I say it's a great refutation of one of the idiot, lefty, peacenik, moronic things of recent times, which is, you know, the kind of anti-Trump, anti-Brexit, so on and so forth. The simpleton's argument. We should build bridges, not walls. Well, it turns out in 2017, all of our bridges are covered in walls.
That brings us neatly on to Trump. Douglas, you earlier this year, rather last year, said Trump won't be as bad as people think.
Hmm.
Do you think you were right?
Well, look, we're sitting here, aren't we? that's something, or at least something. Not nothing. A lot of people seem to imply that when Donald Trump came to office, there'd be almost immediate nuclear war. He would almost immediately nuke all of his enemies, and then they would nuke all of his allies, and then we'd all be dead. It's not much of an exaggeration to say that that was the view. Actually, his first year has certainly not been uneventful, but it hasn't been eventful in any means, like in the manner in which people had I think, expected it. He's got some things done, relatively little. He's every first year of an American presidency is filled with lots of learning curves and lots of problems and lots of opportunities. And it basically it's a much more normal presidency than I think people expect. That's not to say, as I say, there isn't every day dozens stories you can come up with before lunchtime. But the actual facts on the ground are far less eventful than if you'd have, as I say, said at any point in recent decades that in 2017 the president of the United States was Donald J. Trump.
Funny, this time next year, do you think we'll still be talking about Trump's administration?
Well, yes, I mean, inevitably. I think the midterms are going to be very, very interesting. The loss of Alabama last week does suggest there is Democratic momentum building, although, you know, Trump team will point to sort of freakishness of each of these three elections that they've lost this year. But I think you will see, I mean, my prediction is that Democrats will do pretty well. And I think that, again, the thing about Trump is that it's paralysis. I mean, he has achieved some things. And, you know, Americans who support him sort of talk about what he's doing under the hood. You know, that while everybody's distracted with Russia or whatever, he's doing these incredibly dynamic things that are going to, you know, reboot the American economy. I think there is some truth in that. I think, you know, the climate stuff actually is good for the economy. You could say it's terrible for the planet in the long run, but it is good for the American economy. And also the tax cut, which is very, very complicated and does upset Trump's base. So he could really suffer in the midterms because of it. But the tax cut will, you know, get the Wall Street Journal excited, a newspaper that was pretty Trump-phobic until recently started to sound very excited about him. So, you know, rich America will be excited about that. And rich America accounts for a lot.
To make up for the base and the tax cut,
issue. He's got to do something early in 2018.
Not just retweet.
he's meant to be coming to Britain, isn't he?
Really, yes. What he should really do is start to build the wall. He's got to do something like that, something big and bold that he said he'd do that breaks all the rules of the current playbook. That, for his base and others, he can't be seen to be being this captured by the normal run of a presidency.
I mean, another thing, under the hood thing that people point to, is that illegal entry reduced dramatically in Trump's, even though he didn't do anything, there's no wall, there's an increased police presence, but there's no wall of any sort. And yet, illegal entries diminished massively because there's a sort of perception that Trump was tough on immigration. How long that will last is another question.
This leads, by the way, to one of the least covered but happiest stories of 2017, which was a relatively small-scale movement of some people from within America who were worried about their visa status and decided to move north into Canada, where, of course, young Trudeau had been making very... What would you call it? He'd been giving off signals about how different he was from the American president. And when this small number of people started to move to the Canadian border, some hundreds of people, the Canadians panicked. They actually didn't have the resources for it. And the Canadians started turning people away. This should be covered more, because this is what happens when dorm room politics meets reality. Justin Trudeau thought there was only virtue signaling points to get. And in the end, he can't cope with a very small flow of people. Incidentally, I mean, people like him spent all of 2015 saying that Canada should take the numbers of migrants that Germany and Sweden took. If they had have done anything like it, it now becomes clear the Canadian state would have pretty much collapsed. They can't cope with a small trickle from their neighbour in North America.
Of affluent, well-meaning liberals.
Yeah.
And
by the way, sorry, some of those people, just to add to the joy of this story, some of these people are the people who say, I don't feel that America should, I don't like the direction it's going and so on. But actually, Canada doesn't need them because they're people without skills. Mm. There was an investigation into this a couple of weeks ago. They just actually, the Canadian system for entry is fairly rigorous about what you need to bring with you in terms of skills. And it turns out what they really don't need is a lot of full-time yoga practices from California. Who knew?
That was Jonathan Femby, Douglas Murray and Freddie Gray. And for a final Christmas treat, I asked all of the people on this podcast what their political moment of the year was. Here they all are.
I've got a joint winner on a kind of everyone kind of prizes, if that's all right.
That's fine. You can have two. It's Christmas.
So I think my first moment of the year comes during the election campaign, when the cabinet are on the train and then a bus to the venue where the Tory manifesto was launched. And they're all going through this document and seeing what they think are vote-losing policies after vote-losing policies. And they're all kind of whispering to each other quietly to find out who knew about them. And it turns out that basically no one knew about everything that was in there. People knew about what was in very, very narrowly in their own specific area, but not what the whole thing added up to. And I think it does show you how tightly that manifesto process was kept, and also how you ended up with a manifesto that basically had no retail offer beyond this country has a series of serious problems. We don't quite know how to solve them. And here's a policy that goes after homeowners, who are the kind of key Tory demographic. My other moment of the year was the Juncker-May press conference after the lunch, after the EU deal had collapsed at that lunch, because Jean-Claude Juncker at that moment would have been in some ways been within his rights to basically say, this is ridiculous. You turn up here, this text is agreed, then some minor provincial party in your country kicks off and we have to restart the whole thing. This is ridiculous. And I think if he had done that, it would have told us that there was not going to be a deal at the end of the process. But the political warmth and cover he gave Theresa May, and the veil of secrecy that has been in the leakiest place in politics, Brussels, that has been thrown over the moment in that lunch when Theresa May realised that she couldn't go through with it because Arlene Foster objected, I think tells you that the EU side really are serious about a deal and they're going to help Theresa May get there. We all, including me, will forget that in the next 18 months or so, but that is ultimately why there is going to be an EU-UK deal at the end of all this.
I think Jeremy Corbyn at Glastonbury. It was a moment which just kind of summed up this movement that had caught a lot of us by surprise, safe to say, but also just kind of the energy behind it, which was something that, yeah, you can laugh at or say, you know, he's too much of a Marxist to get a power, but it is something the Tories really need to contend with. The idea of a Tory going to Glastonbury in a way is unthinkable, and then you have someone headlining the pyramid stage.
My political moment of the year actually was when I was in Washington in the fall, and everyone was talking about various things to do with defence arrangements and cooperation and NATO and so on. And it suddenly just occurred to me, you know, we are talking in a world where Harvey Weinstein's just succeeded in bringing down the British Defence Secretary. No one knows the rules anymore. No one knows what the causality is in this world at the moment. And people talk about things as if they are eminently predictable still. And if we'd been sitting here last year and you'd said, what do you think is going to happen in 2017? One of the things I would not have said is that Harvey Weinstein is going to crash the world. But then he did. And there was nothing anyone could do about it. And all these movements just go, for good and ill, and it's obviously both, they just go washing across the culture. And take anyone with it. If you'd said to me last year, do you think your closest enemy is going to be taken down by Harvey Weinstein? I'd have said no. And that's not Michael Fallon, that's Tariq Ramadan. So there you go. I always thought it was going to be a very, very brilliant point I'd make in debate one time that would be so, so sparkling and incisive that it would just strike the man dead like that. Turns out Harvey Weinstein did it.
I think for me the political moment was the laughter of the audience in the Sky debate at Theresa May. It reminded me very much of a supply teacher who's just lost the class. And for someone who so much of her brand and appeal was this solidity and calmness and serenity, that, I think at least, was the moment when I went, no, it's over. It will never again be the same. Because I just think Prime Minister can recover from an awful lot, but the laughter of the audience, you can't recover from that.
Well, I think it was Xi Jinping's appearance at the World Economic Forum at Davos, where he made this speech about, you know, we're all for globalization, open trade, fighting climate change, etc., ignoring completely what was actually going on in many of the aspects in China. And at the end of that, the president of the World Economic Forum embraced him and said, metaphorically at any rate, but I think he probably also did so physically, and said, you know, we've been deeply worried about where the world is going, but you have brought us relief and comfort, President Xi.
Well, I'm going to have to be repetitive and say Theresa May standing there and saying nothing has changed, when her entire world had changed. And that moment crystallised both a bad policy decision and a need to do a U-turn, and then a leader who was unable to face up to the fact that she'd done a U-turn and then to communicate it. It crystallised everything that was wrong with that campaign in one 10-second soundbite.
Well, I think my political moment of the year was a funny one when Trump met Macron and his wife Brigitte Macron, much older than Emmanuel Macron, as everyone knows, and he looked at her and looked sort of flabbergasted, or sort of faux flabbergasted, and said, you're in such great physical shape. And then he looked at Macron and said, isn't she in great shape? She's in great shape. And I thought that, for me, sums up the madness of Trump. You've got the leader of the free world. People would say he was objectifying her. I don't think it's that. I think he's just an extremely ridiculous person.
Well, I'm tempted to go along with Tim and talk about the manifesto backfiring, but excluding the election, it would be the moment where Theresa May lost her voice on stage. When it comes to sheer political drama, I will never forget not being able to believe my eyes, that the one time she needed to show strength, she was actually imploding. And I'll say this for her, that she has been through and survived more setbacks than any other major political leader that I can think of in recent years. David Cameron bolted when the referendum went against him. William Hague bolted after he lost the general election. There's a great instinct of thinking, OK, I've tried this, I've failed, I'm going to run for the hills and hide under my bed. And I'll say this for Theresa May, she is a fighter and she keeps coming back again and again. And the fact that she is still Prime Minister after everything going wrong with her for her in such a spectacular way shows that she actually has a quality of resilience, which is something that we do need right now. I'm not exactly saying I want her to be, you know, Prime Minister for very long, certainly not into the next general election, but I will say that her indefatigability has been quite something to behold.
That's all for this week and this year. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows in case you want to have a listen over Christmas. We've got Coffee House Shots, our politics podcast. There's the Spectator Books podcast hosted by Sam Leith. There's Freddie Gray's Americano, which looks at Trump's America. And then there's Holy Smoke, our religion podcast hosted by Damian Thompson and Christina Rodone. And if you like the podcast, now is the perfect time to try the magazine. You can get a year's subscription to The Spectator for just £99, which is 60% off the magazine's cover price. And we'll even throw in a bottle of Berry Brothers delicious champagne. To get this perfect Christmas present for a loved one, or just for yourself, you deserve it for making it through to the end of this podcast, just go to spectator.co.uk/Christmas podcast offer. That's all for this week. See you in 2018.